On the 9th of November 1975, 50 years ago to the day, Australia's most notorious Governor-General, Sir John Kerr, rang the Chief Justice of the High Court, Sir Garfield Barwick, and asked him for a meeting to discuss his intention of dismissing Prime Minister Gough Whitlam, an action that, of course, he infamously took on the 11th of November 1975. In 2012, Sir Anthony Mason, who was on the High Court in 1975 and went on to become Chief Justice, confirmed that he also spoke with the Governor-General on the 9th of November and even drafted a dismissal letter, though Kerr didn't use Mason's draft. Mason told Kerr that he should warn Whitlam he'd be dismissed if he didn't call an election, advice that Kerr did not follow. The behind-the-scenes involvement of High Court judges in the dismissal was and remains controversial. Although, as a later High Court Chief Justice, Robert French, has pointed out, a Governor-General getting legal advice from the Chief Justice was far from unprecedented. Mr. French was Chief Justice of the High Court from 2008 until 2017, and I'm very pleased to say that he joins us now on Sunday Extra. Welcome, Mr. French.
Good morning.
Mr. French, is there a constitutional basis or rationale for a Chief Justice of Australia outside of a High Court proceeding giving advice to the Governor-General about the scope of their power?
No, there's nothing in the Constitution which confers that kind of role on the Chief Justice or any Justice of the High Court, nor is there anything in a statute which confers that kind of role. Really, what happened at that time in terms of the Chief Justice giving advice to the Governor-General reflects a practice that had started before Federation, with colonial governors and chief justices, and in the states. And indeed, there were previous examples of chief justices of the High Court giving advice to governors general. So it was a matter of, there was a historical practice, a different historical perspective, if you like, in those times, which had perhaps hung around until 1975.
It's interesting you describe it as a historical practice. I think in a previous speech, you've referred to it as an established tradition. Would that amount to a constitutional convention?
No, I wouldn't think so. No. In terms of the state chief justices, of which, of course, Sir Samuel Griffith, the first High Court Chief Justice, had been one. He'd been a Chief Justice of Queensland before he was appointed to the High Court. They also occupied the role of Lieutenant Governor. So they were actually carrying out gubernatorial or vice regal roles from time to time when the governor was absent. There was a lot, perhaps, closer relationship. And there are plenty of examples, and which I gave in the paper which I delivered back in 2009, of state chief justices giving advice to state governors. Now, very often, the state governor would first ask the premier of the state whether it was okay to talk to the chief justice, and that permission was generally given. The examples of the chief justice of the High Court communicating with the Governor-General, providing advice to the Governor-General, really begin with Sir Samuel Griffith. And there are examples of 1909 and 1914. A lot of them had to do with double dissolution questions.
And some of them, as I think you've said, were quite striking in their tone.
Yeah. There was one where Sir Samuel Griffith actually reached out to the Governor-General without us to tell him there was some conscription regulations coming before the High Court which were under challenge, which were likely to be found to be invalid, and that would be a disaster, and somebody should tell the government and help with the drafting of new regulations if necessary.
I take it that was a practice that didn't continue into your tenure?
No, we never gave an advance warning. And Don Markwell, who's a social scientist and historian, has written a very interesting paper on that, which sets out quite a few of those examples.
Yes, there are certainly many, many more instances than I suspect many people would have imagined, including in the other less famous dismissal in Australian history, when the New South Wales Labor Premier Jack Lang was dismissed by Governor Philip Game on the 13th of May 1932. It seemed that the New South Wales Chief Justice, Philip Street, was pretty heavily involved in advising Governor Game before that action.
Yes, apparently Lang had issued some circular instructing public servants not to pay money to the Federal Treasury, as is required to do by law. And in Game's opinion, this was illegal. And there was a lot of conversation going on between Governor Game and Chief Justice Street. And in the event, the governor dismissed Lang. And then Lang, in a later interview, said of that consultation that the consultation which was frequent and extensive, was without the permission of the cabinet, though it's apparently suspected by Lang. And Lang blamed Street for Gaines' refusal to accept his advice and spoke of, quote, our enemies led by the Chief Justice of New South Wales, unquote.
Right. Well, so clearly that instance didn't lead to a change in the practices of Chief Justices and communications with governors and Governor General.
That's right, at the state level, yeah.
On Sunday Extra, we're speaking with Mr. Robert French, a former Chief Justice of the High Court of Australia. And Mr. French, a few of the instances that you've mentioned in your paper, and you've also referred to this, involved the governor or the governor general getting the okay from a prime minister or premier in question. That practice seems in some ways more consistent with democratic principles. Would you agree?
Yeah. It doesn't mean that in light of our views, our philosophy, if you like, about separation of powers and so forth today, that it makes it any more desirable. But certainly it would have seemed to be a reasonable thing to do, respect for the democratically elected government, that before the governor or governor general, as it were, proposes to seek the advice of the Chief Justice, they should get the permission of the premier or the prime minister, as the case may be. Now, in a sense, that's looking backwards to a practice which has, I think, vanished.
Let's move then to the Chief Justice who was in the hot seat at the time in 1975, Chief Justice Garfield Barwick. And I think it's fair to say that advising Governor General John Kerr before Whitlam's dismissal wasn't the first time that Chief Justice Barwick had given advice to a Governor General.
Yes, that's right. There was advice in relation to the disappearance of Harold Holt, and advice was sought as to what steps should be taken in relation to the appointment of a temporary successor. And Barwick advised that it would be okay to appoint Jack McEwen, provided that he resigned when the Liberal Party had elected a leader. He was the leader of the Country Party, or whatever it was called at that time.
Garfield Barwick, I suppose, was a very particular figure in the sense that, as well as being the Chief Justice and an esteemed jurist, he'd also been Federal Attorney General in the Liberal government. He explained his decision to give advice to Sir John Kerr by citing the history that we've been talking about, but also saying that it was a legal question, not a political one, but also a legal question that was not justiciable. Could you explain that distinction for us and perhaps whether you find it a convincing one?
Well, a question is not justiciable if the courts won't entertain it. For example, if it's essentially a political question, which doesn't really have a legal dimension, which doesn't concern the legal limits on power and so forth, a court might say this is not a matter for judicial determination, this is a matter for political decision making. The problem with the position that Barwick took when he asserted confidently that it was not justiciable is that that wouldn't prevent somebody coming before the High Court subsequently to argue that it was. And then you're sitting on the High Court, unless you recuse yourself, having asserted confidently that it wasn't justiciable. So I don't think one can ever make that kind of assertion with absolute confidence, because it often involves a multidimensional sort of judgment. And quite apart from that, if you have any lawyer making any statement with 100% confidence, you should seek a second opinion.
Well, indeed, Sir John Kerr apparently did seek a second opinion, although Barwick was the second opinion after he'd spoken to Anthony Mason previously. But I wonder if we could speak now, Mr. French, about the effect of those events in 1975. Do you think it resulted in a permanent change in the tradition of the Chief Justice providing legal advice to the Governor General?
Well, I think it certainly, as Sir Gerard Brennan said in a eulogy relating to Sir Garfield Barwick, those events were very controversial and for that reason would not be likely to happen again. Sentiment with which I agreed in my paper as Chief Justice. I think there are two factors at play here. One is, of course, the great controversy that was associated with the discovery that Sir Garfield Barwick had been involved in advising and so forth, and Sir Anthony Mason's involvement as well, which he acknowledged generated the controversy. So that there's that. So it puts the court, or potentially put the court into the public spotlight, if you like, at the centre of this political controversy. The second factor is a changing view on courts about the reviewability of executive power, the separation of powers, and the notion that, for example, that let's take it at the federal level, where we say that no federal judge should be exercising any role given to them by government, whether it's judicial or not, which is incompatible with their role as a federal judge, the exercise of federal jurisdiction. And there's been quite a development of doctrine along those lines. And the same applies to state judges. So there's a strengthening, if you like, of the notion of separation of powers and not mixing up the role of the judicial power with the role of the legislative and the executive power. Of course, judges review judicially executive power from time to time. So that, coupled with the political controversy that emerged as a result of the 1975 events, I think has led to a situation where it is highly unlikely that anything like that would happen again. Now, as I've just said, you never say never in the law. You never say anything with absolute confidence, because as a famous American judge once said, the life of the law is not just logic, but experience.
So obviously, times have changed and practices have changed, but is it still the case that there's not, if you like, a different formal mechanism by which a governor general can get advice on constitutional issues that might come before them?
Well, the governor general might, with the permission of the prime minister, for example, I don't know what the practice would be today, but might seek advice of the Commonwealth Solicitor General, who's the second law officer of the Commonwealth. I did suggest in my 2009 paper on this whole question that it might be appropriate to have as a fallback position some kind of panel from whom someone could be chosen, might be retired High Court justices or eminent constitutional law academics, to whom the Governor General could resort when feeling the need to seek advice on matters going to the exercise of constitutional powers.
And I took it from what you said there that the virtue of that sort of arrangement would be that it would be public and clear, established in advance of any particular question or controversy.
Exactly right. And I linked it to my proposition that advice to a Governor General from a Chief Justice or a judge of the High Court has no greater formal standing than advice from a senior barrister or legal academic. It's not the exercise of a constitutional function. It might have been a practice rooted in history. But really, in fact, one of the suggestions made by, I think it was Lord Denman to his successor, when he was being asked from whom should I seek advice, one of the people he mentioned was Professor Harrison Moore, who at the time of that discussion was a very distinguished constitutional academic and writer of a major text on the Constitution. So it's when you look at the Constitution, you say there's no role for the Chief Justice. So in what capacity is the Chief Justice asked for his or her view by a Governor General? And you can't distinguish the formal capacity from that of a senior silk or a senior academic.
And it's interesting you mentioned the possible role of a Solicitor General or something like that. As I recall it, in 1975, that was something that the Prime Minister had specifically prevented or forbidden the Governor General trying to avail himself of.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, clearly the events of 1975 cast a long shadow even to this day, and it obviously had an impact on the practices of Governor Generals as well. I get the impression, Mr. French, that you weren't regularly getting calls from various Governor Generals seeking freebie legal advice about constitutional matters?
Not at all. And people who want constitutional advice from a High Court judge on constitutional matters should ask all seven of them, and they might find a 4-3 split.
Well, it's been fascinating discussing these matters with you. Thank you so much for joining us on Sunday Extra.
My pleasure.
Mr. Robert French was Chief Justice of the High Court of Australia from 2008 to 2017.
Find more great ABC RN stories that take you beyond the headlines on the ABC Listen app.